This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking and anxiety about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity and reflection. One of the added values to making this podcast so far has been hearing from listeners. I've heard from people, both friends and strangers, through a variety of social media platforms, most often sharing things they themselves will miss when they're dead. It's wonderful. You're basically just eavesdropping on my therapy session here, but knowing that others are thinking about the simple pleasures is, yeah, a pleasure. There have also been some questions. One of the people who bought me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/Michael, M-I-K-A-E-L, and thank you so much for that, was a guy who really wanted to know what instant coffee I drink. Actually, a few people were wondering that. It's Nescafe Gold, with emphasis on the gold. It's a big difference. It seems to be the standard here in Copenhagen if people serve you instant coffee when you're visiting. Thanks to others for recommendations about other good instant coffee for me to consider. The answer to the question from Claire is 72. I've had offers of longboard lessons, and I've seen photos of new journals that people have bought and depressing videos of people who are better than me at skipping stones. But hey, maybe I should start a Facebook group. I changed the music in the intro. I like the music I've been using, but a friend of mine made it for another podcast about urbanism, The Life-Sized City. So I've been listening to it for a couple of years. Last week, I decided to have a look around for a new melody. I spent a long time listening to hundreds of tracks. It is wild how music changes everything. I sat there playing around with different styles, like this. This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to my happy place. My podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity. My podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity. This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Yeah, so that was 3 or 4 hours of my life spent doing that. But having a laugh, so I guess it's okay. Rabbit holes aren't always a pursuit of knowledge. If you're listening to this on iTunes, please take the time to rate the podcast with shiny stars. I hear other people saying this on other podcasts, so it must be a good thing if you do it. Thanks in advance. Right, let's get to it. Welcome to episode 6. Number 31, rabbit holes. Rabbit holes in the modern internet era are really just sinkholes that open up suddenly and swallow you whole as you walk down the sidewalk. More than a cutesy hallucinogenic Alice in Wonderland journey. Such is the ease with which we can search for information and then keep on falling. I was sitting at a cafe at some point in the mid-90s, drinking beers with the boys. We were talking about all sorts of stuff, including how many men had walked on the moon. There were different guesses, and we talked about it at length, without knowing the right answer. We simply didn't have access to it. The evening ended, and we all looked it up when we got home to our internet connections. Then we texted each other on our Nokia mobile phones, taking the piss out of the ones whose guesses were way off.
It's one small step for man.
That seems so old school nowadays. You can source information in a flash on a smartphone and in under 2 minutes, ridicule your conversation partner for not knowing what the hell they're talking about. It is so satisfying.
The eagle has landed.
I love rabbit holes, despite the fact that they are, behaviorally, in the same family as displacement activities. You can follow the true rabbit hole path and delve deeper and deeper into a specific topic. But you can also wander aimlessly through the rabbit warren labyrinth. It starts well. I need to find out the population of Singapore in the 1950s. An hour later, and I know that ketchup originated in Malaysia, called catsup originally. that China, for all their sable-rattling about owning Taiwan, didn't even have a cultural presence in the country until the 1600s. I've watched a few world championship badminton matches, and I'm amazed that the scientific jury is still undecided about why all those cats on YouTube get scared when they see a cucumber. Back in the day, it was hard work, but it was worth it. I had to go to the library. My local branch was lame, so I went to the main library downtown. I had to walk and take the bus and then a train to get there. It took me 40 minutes. It was an epic journey in search of knowledge. You had to want it. The pursuit of learning wasn't walking to the fridge for a snack. It was spent out foraging for food in all weather conditions, growing and cultivating, trapping and killing your own food, preparing it yourself. I spent a lot of time there, hours on end. The rabbit holes were more difficult to navigate. They took longer, but they were rabbit holes all the same. I'm not that guy who says, "You kids today, you don't know how easy you have it." We can, and do, question the evolution of the internet where people get news from Facebook headlines. They don't question sources and all that. Sure, don't let that conversation die. But I wish I had that instant access to information back when I was young. I'm going to miss slip-sliding away down rabbit holes in search of new stuff to know. Number 32, being naked. I had an American friend who moved to Denmark for a year because of a job. She was well-traveled and open to the diversity of different cultures. She went swimming at a local swimming pool a few times a week. After 6 months or so, she confided something in me during a conversation about what it was like to live in Denmark. She said that in her entire life, apart from boyfriends and sex partners, she could count the number of naked people she had seen live and in person on one hand. And she had seen exactly one vagina, her own. Danes are not shy about nudity. Foreigners generally experience a steep learning curve when they're at the swimming pool, as the rules are that you undress, walk naked to the showers to wash yourself, and only then put on your bathing suit. The whole dressing room is populated by butt-naked strangers. And nobody cares. It was disconcerting at first for my American friend to sit there on a bench, getting dressed, while a stranger was standing right in front of her, with one leg up on the bench as they rubbed cream onto their legs, with their private parts visible in great detail. When I tell people from other countries about this, they're like, "What?" When I tell Danes about this perception of our culture, they're like, "What?" And for me, I have always thoroughly enjoyed being naked. Sleeping with any kind of fabric on my body feels unnecessarily restrictive. Walking around the house naked is not something I think about much. Well, until I'm sitting here writing this and I realize, in retrospect, that it is quite liberating. Not long after I moved back to Denmark, I was on the beach with my girlfriend, who would later become my first wife, and her dad. We lay out the towels and settled in. Without ceremony, her dad stripped off all of his clothes. He saw me noticing and informed me, proudly, a little defensively to be honest, that it was his right to be nude on any beach in Denmark. It's been legal since the 1970s. He strode proudly out into the sea. I had no problem with it. I was just a bit surprised. The beach was busy that day. I saw families with kids around us notice his nudity, but the reaction was nothing more than, "Huh, look, naked dude," before they completely forgot about it. You don't see full nudity on beaches very often anymore, to be honest. But you see a fantastic, casual relationship to nudity, and various stages of undress, absolutely everywhere. This body confidence has its roots in the 1920s and 30s, and the German Freikörperkultur, FKK, free body culture, which was also popular in Denmark. It is also firmly connected to the whole horizontal structure of our society. We're all equal, clothed or unclothed. Danes have the lowest level of gelotophobia, the fear of being laughed at, than any other country, measured in a study by the University of Zurich. Only 1.6% of the population say they have a fear of it. In Britain, for comparison, it's 13%. After gym class, my kids are expected to shower in an open shower room with their classmates of the same gender and have done so since a young age. Sex education starts in the first grade here, although at that age it's more about body awareness. Technically speaking, Denmark does not explicitly say that you can be naked anywhere at any time. It's not a right enshrined in the Constitution. The law provides you with the freedom to do it, but it also provides the authorities with the ability to make a judgment call about any given situation. If I strolled down a pedestrian street on a busy Saturday afternoon in the heart of the city, there might be someone who would take issue with that and call the police. They would probably show up and have a chat with me. Really? Really, dude, is this necessary? Probably not. They would ask me to leave or put some clothes on. Although I have a friend back in the day who walked naked with a group of others in a political protest through the city center to City Hall Square. The police were called, and they had a chat with the protesters. They agreed to let them continue as long as they wrapped it up when they were done, or perhaps wrapped themselves up. Beaches, on the other hand, are generally wide open. Outside the walls of my own home, it's not like I'm naked all over the place. A great many people participating in winter bathing do so in their birthday suits. It's the rule rather than the exception. I also have a personal rule that I have to go skinny dipping in the harbor at night at least once every year here in Copenhagen, usually spontaneously with whoever I might be drinking with at my local wine bar that evening. For some reason, I have never been attracted to the idea of being part of a naturist community. I love that it's a normal thing in so many European countries, but it's just not my thing. There are nudist beaches across the continent, and depending on who I'm traveling with on that holiday, spending a day at one of them is pretty awesome. Swimming naked in the ocean is an absolute pleasure, as is lying in the sun afterwards. I'm just not the guy who's going to make it a lifestyle. Occasions do arise when you might not be that keen on being naked. I woke up in the middle of the night in a cool but tiny room at Sanctuary Hotel in New York. I was jet-lagged and groggy, and it was dark. I stumbled around, disoriented, trying to find the bathroom. I turned the doorknob and entered. I realized then I was in the hallway. Click. The door shut behind me, locking me out. I had no choice but to go down the stairs to reception. The receptionist came up with a new key card for me. Also, I was completely naked. Yeah. So that happened. I got back into bed and started laughing uncontrollably. Amazingly, when I posted about it on Facebook, there were a number of people who had experienced the same thing. There was one evening in the summer of 2020, however, where some friends and I performed a thorough test of this fundamental freedom in Danish society. Let's be clear from the get-go. My friends and I had been consuming wine in the center of Copenhagen and having a splendid time. Earlier in the day, a Danish interview with me was published, wherein I was asked some questions for a series about me and my city. One of the questions was, what should Copenhagen export to the whole world? My answer was this. Something so simple and fundamental, but also diffuse as freedom. The freedom to hop naked in the harbor or the sea, to ride your bike home a little bit too drunk, to say yes and no, to enjoy the darkest humor in the world without limits like too soon or too much, to be exactly who you are, to travel out into the world and return home with that, oh, fuck, it is so nice to be back in Copenhagen feeling every single time, to enjoy mutual respect and trust, freedoms that the Nordic model and a healthy work-life balance give to us. It's still a work in progress, but I feel at any given moment more free in Copenhagen than anywhere else in the world. The interview was a topic of conversation at the bar with my friends. We discussed passionately the legality of being naked in public and all the stuff I've mentioned so far. Now, we usually end such sultry summer evenings with the aforementioned skinny dipping in the harbor, and that night was no exception. That is where we were headed. Until we started talking about doing something different, mixing it up a bit. The first idea was lying naked on the grass in the Royal Library Gardens and drinking some more wine. That morphed into another idea, standing naked in front of the statue of our great philosopher Søren Kierkegaard in those same gardens. I knew that Kierkegaard had a habit of sitting naked in his apartment and speaking foreign languages when he was feeling melancholy back in the middle of the 1800s. We decided that we'd strip down and all speak one of our foreign languages to the man, saying whatever we wanted to the legend. A man whose work, in many ways, led to the modern society we enjoy today. The Royal Library Gardens are adjacent to the Danish Parliament, and we thought that they might be closed at night. Probably for security reasons, since Denmark is considered to be high on the list of terrorism targets. In the event that they were, we agreed we would cycle to the graveyard where he was buried and do the same thing. That graveyard doubles as a public park, so topless sunbathing and friends picnicking among the graves have been common there for many years. In the context of Danish culture, it wasn't a weird thing to do. But true enough, the gardens were closed. The area in front of the main entrance of the parliament was largely deserted. Only a few people were walking or cycling past, as it's a through route between neighborhoods, although closed to cars. We were planning to head out to the cemetery when one of us suggested that we test the limits of our freedom right there on the spot, in front of the seat of Danish democracy. If it was, indeed, a freedom we enjoyed, then what better place to test it? In a flash, we were out of our clothes. Except our shoes, because one of my friends had a theory that you feel more naked when you keep your shoes on. So we decided to try that. A bottle of wine was opened and passed around. Our spirits were high. People cycled past and rang their bike bells in approval. It's a Copenhagen thing. Some called out, "You're so crazy, that looks like fun," in friendly tones. People stopped to talk to us, usually starting with, "Why are you doing this?" with wide, incredulous smiles. The answer was simple. Because we can. Some assumed it was a protest of some sort. It was, however, simply a pro-test of our freedom. You see what I did there? Yeah. Maybe you're from a culture where such actions are regarded in a vastly different light. That's all fine. Nobody is expecting you to do it. We didn't expect anyone passing by to join in. We asked some of them, but we respected their decision not to do it, just as they respected our decision to do it. We probably spent half an hour cavorting jovially on the steps of our parliament. We were fully expecting the police to show up and maybe ask us to put our clothes on, which is really all they would have done, but no popo. One of the passersby was going to take a photo of us on the steps. As we were getting into position, a parliament guard came through the main door, the first and only authority figure to appear. In a dry-as-you-like Copenhagen accent, he said this, "You might want to get off the steps. The alarm keeps going off inside because you're too close to the building. It looks like a lot of fun, but just so you know, there are cameras all over the place." With a wave, he went back inside. Yeah, that was it. It was amazing. We were about to wrap it up anyway, so it was a fine, gentle nudge. Before we got dressed, I read aloud from my interview answer that I mentioned before. To hammer out what living free in Copenhagen truly means and to underline the importance of our exercise on those steps. I realized at that moment that the Parliament Guard, in his response to our craziness, was a de facto representative of Denmark and Danish society. Think about it. First, the pragmatic. You might want to get off the steps. The alarm keeps going off inside because you're too close to the building. Just some friendly professional advice. He was just doing his job, and he didn't need the hassle of listening to the alarm. Our inherent mutual respect in Denmark meant that we understood that instantly. We certainly didn't want him to have a crappy shift. Then the personal. It looks like fun. A citizen recognizing other citizens' behavior, whether he would do such things himself or not. And finally, the friendly warning. But just so you know, there are cameras all over the place. He assumed that we would be aware of that, with the parliament being one of the highest security locations in the nation, but giving some inebriated people a reminder is never a bad idea. We were well aware that every nook and cranny of the area was probably covered by state-of-the-art surveillance equipment. We joked about it, accepted that fact, and made our choices anyway. We were in Denmark, so all would be fine. One of my friends made an interesting point. The guard could have called in the alarm. That's his job. But by watching his screens and making a judgment call, he was, in effect, our advocate, the middleman between us and a flock of heavily armed police and security forces who would descend upon the location in a flash if he pushed that button. And nobody wanted or needed that. It would be a waste of everyone's time and a lot of taxpayer funds. And to our fellow citizens at the police and the Danish Secret Service, we hope you had a good laugh and enjoyed the show on your screens. They are trained and paid to protect our freedom. But we, the citizens, should at any given time, and always within reason, be prepared to test it. We got dressed and rode our bikes away, my friends waving as they turned down streets and headed home, one after one. We were drunk, absolutely, but we possessed a clarity about our actions and our desire to put our freedom to the test. We were elated as we pedaled home through the glorious Nordic night. We felt free. Number 33, bacon. Yeah, I got nothing more for you than that, really, because, you know, it's bacon. Duh. Number 34, stairs. The idea of including this came to me as I was walking up the stairs to my ex-wife's apartment here in Copenhagen. She lives on the fourth floor in the apartment that we bought together back in the day. Even though I've been up and down those stairs countless times, it still feels like a never-ending story. You lose track of what floor you're on, but if it's a stairway that you know well, you keep checking the signs on the doors to track your progress. You have inadvertently memorized them simply because of the stair journey. Rasmussen, Larson, Anderson, oh, I'm getting close. But once you're locked into it and you're halfway up, you resign yourself to it, and you commit to the climb. At that point of no return, I not only accept the burn in my thighs, but I embrace it. In a spot of soul-searching, which seems to be a primary component in preparing this podcast, I'm guessing that growing up in a suburban home in North America is at the root of this affection for stairs. In my childhood home, there were about 6 steps up to the back door. That's it. Even though I've now lived in many other cities around the world at various apartment elevations, it still feels exotic. When you work in urban design, and your work also involves urban planning and architecture, it's easy to get all romantic about stairs. They are quite simply the first permanent man-made structures in human history. If you think about it, they even predate our constructed dwellings. Nobody will ever know who the first human was who decided to carve some steps into huge logs of wood that had fallen across a frequently used path, or into the stone of a steep cliff face in order to get home to the cave. Generally, a sentiment like that is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. All the stuff that we take for granted in our lives was thought up and invented by one person. Just like the wheel. The wheel might have evolved in different parts of the world, but in each instance, there was one person who went, "Huh, wow, cool, what if we just did this?" That human told some other humans, and they thought it was a great idea, and things just rolled from there. Another example is the keel, one of the key inventions that allowed the Vikings to sail farther across the open sea than ever before. Some human in this region thought long and hard about why boats tipped over in the wind and got this bright idea to stick a piece of wood out of the bottom to stabilize it. That we don't know who it was and will never know is so frustrating to me. But yeah, I digress. Stairs are free exercise, and when you live an active life, that's pretty cool. Whenever I get off a plane at an airport somewhere and all the passengers file onto the escalator, I'm the guy taking the stairs 2 at a time in order to get some blood flowing back into my legs and to get ahead of all those people in the passport queue. My kids used to grumble when I said, "Hey, let's take the stairs," but I've noticed that lately they don't. They seem to have gotten used to it. When you live in an old European city like Copenhagen or Paris or many other places, stairs are the only way to get up or down. So you just have to suck it up. There's no way around it. Even though I'm sentimental about having to walk up to the 4th floor to visit my ex-wife, I do harbor a secret sense of gratitude that I only live on the 1st floor. It's not so much that it requires less effort to get home. I find that I use the back courtyard much more because I'm closer to it. My ex-wife and I always said that we should use the courtyard more often, have dinner down there or a cup of coffee in the afternoon. But we did it so rarely because it was a bit of a schlep all the way down. Indeed, where I live now, I know that it's only those of us on the 1st 2 floors who use the back stairs and spend much more time in the courtyard. My neighbors from the top floors, I never see them down there at all. In my poetic waxing about stairs, I remember a job that I had here in Copenhagen, and one that many of my friends have also had. For many Saturdays at one point in my life, I would deliver the post in Copenhagen neighborhoods. It was a classic part-time job for many. While I had not yet developed my passion for spreadsheets, I still tried to document data in my head and sometimes wrote it down in my journals. I failed miserably at calculating how many stairs I went up and down on an average Saturday delivering the post. All that romantic stair climbing has now gone in Denmark, as most apartment buildings have post boxes down by the main door. Never mind the fact that this is one of the world's most digital nations, so getting anything in my post box is a massive event. Last year, I received exactly 2 letters. That's it. When you're young and living in Copenhagen, like in many other places, you find yourself moving apartments rather frequently. The ultimate test of friendship is when you ask for help with moving. The first question when you ask them is always, "What floor do you live on?" The higher the answer, the more bait you need to inspire your friends to help. Beer and pizza when we're done. Come on, please, help me out. Think about all the different kinds of stairs. I do. I think about how it feels to walk down the different types. There's a different feeling when I walk down the tight, winding staircase at the back of my building compared to the main stairs leading down to the street. Who doesn't feel like they're a character in a French film when they're walking down a wide, spiral staircase? It feels like you should slow down and graciously descend. Architecturally, important buildings populated by important people forced you to subjugate yourself upon arrival. You had to embark on a long, hard climb in order to reach their lofty heights. Stairs provide access, but they also keep the peasants in their place. In a modern world where accessibility is, thankfully, in focus, we are more aware about stairs as a barrier than ever before. Apart from visiting friends in apartment buildings in Copenhagen, my most extreme stair experience is visiting the Eiffel Tower. I'm not a man who visits tourist destinations in any city, but I have a secret passion for the Eiffel Tower. I even have it tattooed on my body, so there you go. If you visit the Eiffel Tower, make sure you take the stairs up to the second level, if you can. The added benefits to the inherent exercise is that the queue for tickets is always shorter, and I believe it's also cheaper than taking the elevators. I must have taken the stairs on the Eiffel Tower 30 or 40 times, at least. I like that stairs are the original man-made structure, and that most humans in the world have taken stairs. Okay, wait, now I'm thinking about that, of course. Apart from people with disabilities, there are humans on the planet who have no need for stairs. But hey, stairs nonetheless feature prominently in art, literature, and music, with their symbolism and their mystery. In classical art, absolutely, but also cinema. Off the top of my head, Gone with the Wind, Inception, Rocky, The Shining, Battleship Potemkin, The Spanish Steps, Joker, and in music, yeah, that classic, Stairway to Heaven. I like how when humans developed the skills to build houses with two floors, they realized that they needed a good way to get up and down that was better than a ladder. In the rabbit hole that I fell down thinking about this, I delved into the history of the ladder as well. But I'm going to spare you that. I also like that there's science involved. You know what, when you walk up and down a certain set of stairs and it just feels odd? Like the stairs are too shallow or too high? After somebody figured out the idea of stairs, other humans stood on their shoulders and figured out the best practice design. There are people in history who dedicated their entire lives to optimizing staircase design. Of course there was. In the heart of Copenhagen is the Round Tower, completed in 1642. I guess I got a thing for towers, I just realized. Huh. But what's special about this building is that King Christian IV, who was a bit of a prolific architect, the funder of architects, had it designed so that he didn't have to use stairs when visiting it. He was a large, overweight man, so instead you walk up a long spiral ramp to the top of the tower, and the king would have himself pulled up in a horse-drawn carriage. This anti-stair design was a status symbol. As legend would have it, he was trying to impress the Tsar of Russia with a building like that. I like walking up that ramp, but I really like the fact that at the end of it, in order to get up to the viewing platform on the top of the tower, you have to navigate an incredibly tight granite spiral staircase, which triggers my claustrophobia. But the view at the top is the reward. Now, of course, other humans also decided to invent something to avoid taking the stairs as well. The elevator is one thing, and it's an obvious one once buildings started getting taller. But the escalator is a replacement for the stairs, and I'm glad that there is a culture of people standing on one side of the escalator so that people like me can continue to walk up. I have to restrain myself from saying escalators were meant to speed up taking the stairs, not replace them as I pass people. Don't even get me started on rolling sidewalks like the kind you see in airports. They were designed to expedite our journey across longer distances, not replace the act of walking. Okay, I'll shut up now. I'm going to miss feeling the burn in my thighs and in my lungs as I ascend, as well as feeling that thrilling sensation of gravity as I take the steps two at a time on my way down. Number 35, missing my children. With 100% certainty, I will miss my children. Well, now that they're both teenagers, yeah, we're still well above 70% certainty, at least at time of writing. I mean, it's a yo-yo, right? But of course, I love them madly. But yeah, watching these two amazing humans continue to grow and develop is a pleasure. I feel like a football coach on the sidelines after years of helping them develop skills at the academy. I'm rooting for them like their biggest fan, but I'm still barking out advice, hoping that they'll hear it above the noise of the stadium. After having been there when they took their first steps, spoke their first words, mastered a bicycle, watching them grow and develop is less dramatic. The plot points in the dramaturgy of their stories are more like subtle art house films than a Hollywood blockbuster. But I have a lifetime subscription to these two human streaming services that consistently produce quality programming, entertainment, documentary, educational, and lots of drama. I wouldn't miss any of it for the world. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. If you like what you're hearing, slap some shiny stars on the rating on iTunes, and you can buy me a coffee. Check out how over at buymeacoffee.com/Michael, M-I-K-A-E-L. I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Catch you next time, and thanks for listening.